Hi everyone. I have sad news to share in today's episode. Our community has recently suffered a major loss. Linda Andre, author of one of the most important books on ECT ever written, passed away this month. Linda was my hero. I first came across her work when I was desperately searching the internet for answers when ECT damaged my brain and my doctors refused to believe me. Reading her presentation, ECT as a Head Injury, changed my life. It showed me that ECT does cause permanent brain damage, and those harmed by ECT are regularly denied testing and rehabilitation like I was. It also showed me there was hope for recovery through the stories of several people who found ways to rehabilitate themselves when doctors wouldn't help them. Not long after reading her presentation, I found her book, Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment. And it gave me perspective on the history and politics and controversy surrounding ECT I never would have understood on my own. And it showed me what I was up against as a survivor. I would regularly come across Linda's work while researching ECT. I always felt a thrill, like, wow, if Linda was here, I'm on the right path. The depth and quality of her work always blew my mind. I think that we have her to thank for the amazing letters to the FDA during the 2011 reclassification attempt. I aspired to research and argue like her, and I hoped one day I'd be able to correspond with her. You know, be able to thank her personally for giving me hope and for fighting for all of us. And to tell her I took her book with me wherever I traveled. Having the truth of what happened to me in writing was a great source of comfort in a world where nobody believes us. Sadly, I'd never get the chance. I was really, really devastated when I heard the news she passed away. I still haven't processed it, to be honest. I've been honored with the opportunity to share two of her interviews to this podcast. The first you can find a link to in the show notes. This one took me longer to publish because of health reasons, and also because I wanted to write a blog post that did her work justice. But with my disabilities, writing coherently takes an absurdly long time, and I'm still struggling to find the right words. If you read any book on ECT, read Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment. It's the most comprehensive work on the subject, and it really helps you see the big picture. I'd like to preface this audio with a disclaimer. Life After ECT supports the Audit ECT campaign. You can learn more about the Audit ECT campaign in the show notes. And without further ado, an interview with Linda Andre.
Good morning. Shock treatment, also known as electroconvulsive therapy, also known as ECT, has been touted in the general media since the 1970s as a miracle cure for emotionally disabled and even suicidal people. However, Linda Andre begs to differ. She is the author of Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment, published this year by Rutgers University Press. Good morning, Ms. Andre.
Good morning, Philip.
How did shock get started?
Shock was invented in a very different social and cultural and political climate than today. It was invented in 1938, and back in the early part of the century, we had very different attitudes toward mental patients. There was an active eugenics movement which held that mental patients were genetically defective, biologically inferior, and a threat to society, and anything that could be done to control them was considered justified. And the things that were done back then, we wouldn't do today, forcibly sterilizing mental patients, for instance, forbidding mental patients to get married. Of course, mental patients are still segregated in institutions, but the eugenics movement went even farther than that, and it advocated even for what it called euthanasia, or killing of mental patients. And this actually took place in the 1930s in Germany. It didn't take place in the United States, but there were advocates of euthanasia in the highest reaches of psychiatry and neurology. And it was socially acceptable to say that mental patients ought to be killed for their own good and the good of society. It was in this context that shock treatment was invented, and it was one of a number of drastic somatic treatments that aren't used anymore that horrify us to think about today, such as injecting people with malaria or putting them to sleep for weeks at a time. Shock treatment is the only one of those procedures that survives today. Shock was invented by Italian psychiatrists who reasoned incorrectly that if you had seizures or epilepsy, you couldn't also have mental illness. And they set out to create artificial seizures in the brains of mental patients. They got the idea to do this with electricity. They experimented on hogs and dogs and killed a whole bunch of them. Figured out how to do it without killing them. Then they went to find a human subject to experiment on. So they took an unwilling person, hooked him up to the homemade shock machine, put electricity through his brain. And when he didn't die, they touted this as a cure for mental illness.
Why does your book focus on the period since the 1970s?
This is when patients' rights laws began to be passed. This was seen as a real threat by the shock industry because they reasoned that if people could say no to shock, they would say no. Nobody would want to have it. They knew very well by this time that shock caused brain damage. They knew it caused permanent amnesia. They knew it couldn't be done without causing these effects. So they saw this as a crisis, and they tried to figure out what to do about it. And their solution was to come up with a public relations line that would convince the public that shock was safe. They could have chosen differently. They could have chosen to investigate shock, to look at it, for instance, with the new brain scanners like the CAT scan and see what it did to the brain. But they knew what that was going to show. So instead, they wrote up a script and they stuck to it ever since. And I argue it's probably one of the most successful public relations campaigns ever because it's convinced people to this day that shock treatment is safe when it isn't. It's convinced people that it's new and improved when it isn't. In fact, it's more dangerous today than it was back in the 1930s. It's convinced people that it is effective, which it is not. It's convinced people that shock somehow keeps people from killing themselves, which it does not. And the interesting thing is, whenever I talk to people about shock treatment, they repeat back the public relations line that the APA came up with back in 1970, and they passionately believe this to be true because they've heard it somewhere. Oh, ECT, yeah, it's new and improved. Oh, yeah, it used to be barbaric, but now it's safe. In the 1970s, when the Food and Drug Administration gained jurisdiction over all medical devices, not just the ones used to give ECT, and this was another thing that really frightened the shock industry, because the Food and Drug Administration had many powers. It never ended up using most of these powers, but back then nobody knew that. For instance, it could have conducted a scientific safety investigation of shock treatment to find out what it did to the brain. It could have required the manufacturers to conduct such a safety investigation. It could have taken the shock device off the market. It could have required warnings and labeling to protect patients. None of these things actually ended up happening, but what the FDA did was to come up with a calculation of the risks of shock treatment and to put it into class 3, which is the high-risk category for medical devices, meaning that the device presents unreasonable risk of injury or illness. And it did that back in 1979, and that's still where the shock machine is today.
What are the arguments made by the industry for shock treatment, and how would you respond to them?
The idea that shock is somehow safer or uses less electricity today is just bogus, and this is a physical fact. The fact that shock treatment uses anesthesia now and uses oxygenation during the period when the person is getting shock, all these things actually make shock more dangerous by raising the seizure threshold and making the seizures longer. Shock machines now use more electricity than they did when they were first invented. Now, the claim that shock treatment is effective is very effective. You hear 80-90% effectiveness. If you look at the actual research, you'll find there is almost no research on the efficacy of ECT. There have been only 5 randomized controlled trials of shock treatment versus drug since it was invented. And in fact, there is a large recent study done in 2007 that suggests the efficacy rate of shock treatment is very much lower than the 80 to 90% that they have said. It's more like 30%, and even that is only in the very short term. So this idea that shock is effective is something that is not supported by the evidence. We know that shock causes permanent amnesia because whenever there have been long-term studies of shock patients, following them up for 6 months or more, these studies have always shown that these people suffer amnesia that does not go away. And in fact, the industry has avoided doing long-term studies for the very reason that the studies do show, not only permanent amnesia, but permanent cognitive disability. So when people are told that shock doesn't cause permanent memory loss, the research that there is does not support this claim. In fact, the research shows otherwise. Well, if you don't look for something, you're not going to find it. The research that was done in the early decades of shock, which were autopsy studies, showed that shock caused various forms of brain damage in both human beings and animals. This was consistent in study after study after study. Now, those studies stopped being done around the 1960s. Then the CAT scan was invented, the MRI was invented, and these could have been used to investigate the question of what shock does to the brain. But in fact, what happened was the research money has largely been cornered by men with a financial interest in the shock treatment devices, in shock treatment itself, in promoting it and profiting from it in various ways. And so instead of having a nice, clean brain scan study using an MRI or SPECT or the high-tech devices we have today, you find that these studies don't exist, and there is no scientific reason why they don't exist. It's political.
So is this why critics of shock treatment haven't been able to be heard?
The critics of shock treatment are largely the people who have been through it and who know from personal experience what it's like to have your memory erased, years of your memory sometimes erased, after having been told that there would be no permanent memory loss, who experience cognitive disability after never even having been told that was even a possibility. So on one side, you have the survivors of shock treatment. On the other side, you have the American Psychiatric Association, which stands fast behind it. Now, there's probably no bigger difference in power than that between organized psychiatry and mental patients, especially survivors of shock treatment, who are among the most powerless of the mental patients, because if you had shock, you must really have been crazy. Unfortunately, there have been very few professionals who have taken on the shock industry because there's nothing for them to gain by it. As my old friend Marilyn Rice used to say, she was a shock survivor who helped organize shock survivors into a national organization. No one's bread is buttered on exposing the truth about ECT. People don't even know that the National Organization of Shock Survivors exists. It does. It's called Committee for Truth in Psychiatry. It's been around since the 1970s. But without money, without funding, without political power, without access to the media, it's almost as if we don't exist. On the other hand, you have the APA with vast amounts of money, 35,000 members, lawyers, lobbyists, PR people. It's really not a fair fight.
So how did you research this book?
I've been researching this book for about 25 years, since I myself was forced to have shock treatment and since I myself discovered the hard way about its effects. I kind of devoted my life to finding out about it, and I did that in many ways. I did that by speaking to as many people who had shock as possible. I was fortunate enough to inherit the archives of Marilyn Rice, and this is just a vast amount of source material that I could not have collected myself. It documents the beginning of the mental patients movement in the 1970s and the shock survivors movement shortly afterwards. It contains all kinds of material, letters, flyers, newspapers, newsletters. It's an amazing amount of stuff. And also, all the correspondence between Marilyn Rice and other people who had shock treatment to the Food and Drug Administration. When the Food and Drug Administration decided that it wanted to call shock safe without a safety investigation, people around the country began writing to the Food and Drug Administration. There is now a docket at the FDA that is more than 40 volumes and takes a week to go through. And all of this is material having to do with shock treatment. So I went to the FDA. I sat in the reading room. Anybody can do this. And I went through everything that people had sent in since 1982 up to the present regarding shock treatment. Because there is so much material from people who had ECT. Okay, these people all had the same effects from ECT. They talk about permanent memory loss. They talk about what it did to their lives. They talk about what it did to their families. I included as many of these letters in the book as I could. I would have liked to include a lot more because there are just so many of them and they are so consistent and they are so moving. In addition, there are thousands of letters from the general public concerned about shock treatment, asking the FDA to investigate it for safety, saying, why don't you do this? There are letters from patients' rights advocates. There are letters from concerned professionals. There are many, many politicians who wrote in prodding the FDA, you know, saying, what are the risks of shock treatment? How do you know? Why don't you find out and tell people? In addition, I had collected for me by my colleague Marilyn Rice every article that was published on shock treatment from the beginning to the time that she died. And then after she died, I took on the task of collecting what was published in the medical journals. Not only articles in medical journals, but all media coverage of shock treatment. I don't think anything much got by me. And so, again, I was able to see patterns. Why were all these news articles the same? Why do they all sound like they came from a cookie cutter and all had the same themes? Of course, they were the themes of the APA's public relations script. But having all this material available, you begin to see these themes and you pull them out, and it gives you a perspective that you don't get if you just look at media coverage at one point in time. So I did that. In addition, just by my being out there over the years, I have met, spoken to, corresponded with, read accounts of shock from just probably thousands and thousands of people on the internet and in every other way. So I am kind of a resource for people who have had ECT and have, you know, their own experience and perspective on it. And my job was to give a collective voice to these people in my book.
What about people who say they have benefited from shock?
Shock treatment will make people who are in distress feel better temporarily. It does this by damaging the brain. This is something that neurologists know, but is kind of counterintuitive, that if you have brain damage from any kind of injury, that it will make you euphoric, it will make you forgetful, it will dramatically change your behavior. And if you have been troubled by distressing emotions, it will change your perspective. There is no question about that. But it does so by causing an organic brain syndrome, just like any other type of brain injury. But there are people who are willing to make that trade-off. There are people, most people make that trade-off retroactively in that they weren't told that they would have brain damage, but in the end, they were feeling so bad that they don't mind having been brain damaged. So, you know, I respect that, but that is what is meant by people who have benefited from shock treatment. The other thing that needs to be said is that this is very short-term. All the available research shows that it doesn't last longer than 1 month in exchange for long-term effects that never go away. Even people who publicly say they benefited from ECT and publicly promote it, such as Kitty Dukakis, they admit they have permanent memory loss. Carrie Fisher had ECT. She talks about not being able to remember people who call her up. So it's not that people who feel that they've benefited from shock don't have the permanent adverse effect. It's that in their personal assessment of risk and benefit, they find a way to live with it, make peace with it, or really not mind it. But for most people, that's not the case.
What is going on at the Food and Drug Administration now with respect to shock?
Just a short time after my book was published, and I talk in the book about how the FDA just let the shock machine languish, didn't do anything, refused to investigate it, said it was going to reclassify it, never did so, just kind of let things go for 33 years. Amazingly, shortly after my book was published, the FDA woke up from its sleep, so to speak, not because of anything that advocates or activists did, but it was prodded by another agency of the federal government, which said, hey, FDA, clean up your act. There are all these devices that are on the market being used that have never been tested for safety. You have no evidence of their safety, and yet they're being used on people. Well, this was news to people who hadn't read my book. Of course, it wasn't news to me. And people were shocked, pardon the expression, to find out that the shock machine has never been scientifically investigated and found safe. How could this be that this drastic somatic treatment was given to so many people, we think, over the years without it having been proven safe? So now, after 33 years, the FDA has called on the manufacturers of these devices, saying, give us evidence that your device is safe and effective. And it will be very interesting to see how this plays out. Of course, the manufacturers of the shock machines have historically been supremely arrogant and ignored the FDA regulatory process. In fact, FDA had called on them previously in 1995 to provide safety information. They didn't, and the agency did nothing to them. So there is no reason to think that these manufacturers are going to comply with the FDA process now. The question will be, what happens when they don't? Now, what should happen is that the FDA should require the device to go through the rigorous approval process as if it were a new device. But of course, shock treatment devices cannot do that because they're not safe. Shock machine manufacturers will not do that because they don't think they have to. So then what? If they can't submit clinical trials showing their device is safe, the FDA is supposed to take these devices off the market. But I argue in my book that is just unthinkable. The FDA has caved in to the American Psychiatric Association for 33 years. It's afraid of the American Psychiatric Association. It's not known for standing up to industry. It's known for being friendly to industry. So it cannot take the shock machine device off the market because the shock machine device is a mainstay of psychiatry. It's built into the process of psychiatry. And in fact, psychiatry could not survive without shock treatment. With drugs having been shown to have adverse effects, including suicidal ideation and suicide in young people, psychiatry is really in a crisis because all it really has to offer is drugs and shock. The drugs have been knocked down a peg, and what's left? Shock treatment is what's left. And psychiatry will never let that fall. The APA will never let shock machines be taken off the market. It's politically impossible. So what else could happen? The Food and Drug Administration can, and I predict it will, simply go ahead and declare the shock treatment device safe by placing it into Class 2. And it can do that. It's within its powers to do that. That's what it said it wanted to do all along. It's the same classification as a wheelchair or a thermometer. I mean, think about that. Now, what needs to happen? I think advocates need to wake up. Activists need to wake up. People need to understand what is at stake here. I think there needs to be pressure put back on the FDA, as there has been over the years. Everybody needs to get involved in this. Write to the FDA, call on the FDA, lobby the FDA, and make sure this doesn't happen by putting the public pressure and the spotlight on the FDA, because they're not going to look very good if they just reclassify the ECT device without any evidence of its safety whatsoever.
Given the history of shock treatment, patients deceived by doctors about its risks, is there any way to protect future patients?
I argue in my book, given the choices that the industry has made, and given everything that's gone down over the 70 years of shock treatment's history, that there really is no way to protect patients short of banning shock. Shock cannot be made safe ever. The line that, you know, there is a new kind of shock that's safe now is just public relations. That has been repeated since the 1970s. It's no more true today. People keep falling for it because they don't know the history. Shock cannot be made safe no matter what you do. You can't put electricity through people's brains and not damage their brains. It's not physically possible. People can't be informed of the risks of ECT because that has been tried, and the American Psychiatric Association will not allow it. In fact, it's gone over the years further in the direction of denial of shock's risks than it did back in the 1970s. In other words, it's less honest with patients today, even telling people that shock treatment will improve your memory. That's one of the things in the latest APA guidelines that they tell people. So there has been a movement for over 30 years for informed consent, because theoretically, if you were informed of the risks of shock, you could decide to take those risks knowing what you were getting into. And it could be argued that that would be ethical, that you could choose brain damage if you knew you were choosing brain damage. However, history shows that that hasn't happened. History shows that that really can't happen at this point, because we are too far down the road of denial for the industry to ever turn back. Patients' rights advocates don't have the power to force the industry to change. to force the FDA to adopt a truthful informed consent statement. We can't get the word out to patients about the risks of shock. People are still being lied to. So what do you do in that situation? When you can't have truthful informed consent, when people can't know politically, it's a political reason, it's not a scientific reason. So under those circumstances, and with those circumstances not likely to change for the better, there really only is one way to protect the greatest number of people, and that is simply to ban shock. Because those people who would be helped by it temporarily and would have chosen it had they known can get their benefit in other ways. But the people who are harmed by it permanently and have their lives destroyed can never get back what they lose to shock treatment. And all the evidence that we have is that the vast majority of patients are on the side of being permanently harmed by shock treatment. And I don't think it's moral of us as a society to allow that to happen. So given where we are today and how we got where we are, we have to ban shock, just like we ban other behaviors and other things that are risky, even though, you know, some people may like them. For instance, smoking in offices. Well, some people may like smoking in offices, but they don't have the right to smoke in offices at the risk of harming other people's health. And so the people that would choose shock can't have their right to have brain damage make them feel better temporarily at the cost of harming a greater number of other people. So I argue that a ban is really the only choice we have left at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Andre. Again, the name of this fascinating and provocative book is Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment, again published by Rutgers University Press. And this is Philip Bennett, speaking for the largest minority, WBAI.
Thank you for tuning in to the Life After ECT podcast.